Well, let's have a word of prayer and we begin. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for those who are here, for their interests, for their backgrounds, for the things and ideas that they bring to discussion, and for the subject that's before us. Father, we pray that it's not just information, but factual things. They will cause us to think. And at the end, we pray that this will make some contribution to our being conformed to the image of your only begotten Son, Jesus Christ. For it's in his name we pray, with thanksgiving. Amen. Now, a word at the beginning. Since I've just started speaking, it could only be at the beginning. And that is the title. It's a suggested title, and I've accepted it. But the word that I have some concern about, it's the word successful. So if you came thinking that I am going to guarantee success in what you try to do apologetically or evangelistically, that will not be my objective. And now, I think there's nothing wrong with the word, but whenever we say successful, at least in the West, we have an idea of what success means. And I'm not sure that that's always the same sort of thing that the Bible would say is success. So just a word about that. So I'm hoping it would be successful, but we're talking about how to encounter people with or for the gospel. And it is the role of affections. Richard Weaver once wrote in his seminal work called Ideas Have Consequences, written in 1948, he wrote, "We do not undertake to reason about anything until we have been drawn to it by affective interest." That is, affective, we're drawn to it because we think it's meaningful to us. So when I use the word, and I will use the word sentiment, it is similar to the word affection. If I would say, "What are your sentiments?" In this context, I would be asking you, what things are important to you? See, that's what I mean. What things are important to us? And Weaver said that we don't begin to reason about something until we first see that it's important to us. Now, I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, who wants to sit through a lecture on astrophysicists if you have no interest in it? It's pretty hard to get engaged. I don't mean maritally. I mean engaged in the content. And so careful about words. And I think that's very true. And many times as Christians, I don't think we've given a lot of attention to this. It's, this is what you need to know, and I'm here to tell you, and, well, just to be unkind about it, shut up and listen. And so a person is thinking, while they're sitting there, why am I listening to this? I have no interest in it. So we're going to begin with that thought. C.S. Lewis tells us that imagination is the organ of meaning, but that the organ of truth is reason. So what I will propose is that we start with meaning and reason back to truth, because meaning and truth are not the same thing. Lewis makes that very clear in his book, The Discarded Image. So we'll say a little bit more about that. Imaginative apologetics. And I'm saying reason, as I just said, reason is the organ of truth, it should say, and imagination is the organ of meaning. We often begin with imagination. That is, we begin with talking about the world in which we live in to find out where people have their affections, what's important to them, and we'll look at that. Every person that we deal with, we know that there are certain core of interest to all of humanity, although they tend to be expressed differently. I think Christians ought to have the best understanding of humanity as anybody. What things do people, in a sense, long for? What things do people think are important? And sometimes you have to make a judgment and say, well, I have two things that are important to me, but I'm confronted with this one right now, so I'm going to set this one aside, and I'm just going to go forward with this one. So these are what I've said, we'll call them sentiments or affections, which simply reveal the things that are important to me. So we look at a person's life, one thing, and we could see, what do they devote themselves to? And it's probably they devote themselves to those things because those are the things that are important to them. Now, we could go down and say, well, they're important to them because they make them happy, they make them rich. Yes, that's right. But those are the particulars. I'm just interested in what do they think is important. Now, the why question is a question that everybody asks. You're driving down the highway, and you see an accident in the other lane going in the opposite direction. Now, what's the first thing you start trying to figure out? How did that happen? I wonder who's to blame. How could a car that was traveling in the northbound lane now be heading south? What are we looking for? Meaning. We want meaning. And most of us, though we have varying degrees of interest in that, it is the question that is, I think, just simply intuitive to all of us. Those of you who've had small children, well, even if you had adult children, they were small children at one time. So I do understand the progression here. Now, if you think about that, what are some of the first questions children ask? What are the kind of questions that drive parents just a little bonkers? Why? Why? Well, my father used to say, yours is not to reason why, yours is but to do or die. And I think he meant it. But that's intuitive to us, isn't it? We want to ask questions. And there are also why questions, what questions, when questions. Why? Because we want to know the meaning of an event. All apologetic work is person sensitive. I'm not going to say the negative. Let me just say we need to be careful that we don't pick up different methods that may work really good over here with this person, but they don't really work very well over here. That's why part of our evangelism, part of our apologetics, is finding out who is this person in front of me. Now, sometimes you have more time for that than others, but let's just say that's what we need to be doing because that's how we know where to begin. I will say we're going to work back from meaning to truth. Meaning and truth are not the same thing. But meaning is where we start. Why? Because that's what people are interested in. And then we'll see, well, how do you work it back? The imagination is going to be used to answer the question, why? Why is the world the way it is? Why isn't the world different? Why are people this way? Why is it that some people are really nice and some people are not so nice? So then we began to build sort of this is an overused word, but a worldview. We'd say, well, here's a way to explain why this and why that. And as you begin to get a larger as people talk about Elijah's story. There are certain core desires, I think, within all of humanity, although they get expressed differently. So if you think about, I would imagine that for all of you here, unless somebody put a gun to your head, this subject is important to you. So that tells me something about you. This is important, or you wouldn't be here, because you have other things that you could do. The why question is always associated to one's affections. Remember, Weaver says, we do not begin to reason about things that we have not been effectively moved by. Lewis says, we don't cut down jungles, but we ought to be irrigating deserts. That is, where people's, the way they've been answering the meaning question, the why question, really isn't getting them ahead very far. So rather than trying to tell them why they're wrong about everything, let us begin to tell them about another possibility or another way of thinking things. So as I said, we work backwards from meaning to truth. So let's just say I am talking to somebody and they're saying, well, how do you explain that there's good people, that is, they do good things, and the other hand, there are some people who do very evil things. How can that come out of the same humanity? So now that's a meaning question. It's a why question. So I say to them, well, let's just suppose, what if that we are created in the image of God? I'm not saying you'd say exactly this, but I'm just giving you an example. And supposing that mankind was made for the garden, he wasn't made for the grave. Just supposing that something happened to mankind, and though he is made in the image of God, and he's very noble, on the other hand, because he's a fallen creature, he can also be very sinful. Now, all I've said is, let's suppose that would explain your question of why. Now you see, the next step would be, if it goes anywhere, would be, okay, is this explanation I've just given, now we're going to push it to see if there's any truth in it, okay? But I didn't start there. I started with meaning. So the question, if the question is not asked, then we create the why question. And we can talk about that. And as I said, imagination is used. It paints a picture to give meaning to life. I grew up on a farm, and many nights when we would get out of it was a dairy farm, but we'd get out of the hay field late at night, and we're milking cows to 10:30, 12 o'clock at night. That's why I'm no longer a farmer, just a philosopher, and some people think they do the same thing. For those who know anything about farming, you might know what I mean. And so we would be out in the barn milking, and we had milking machines, so that was one good thing. But I can remember my mom saying, boys, because I had an older brother, boys, God will reward you for this in heaven. Now, my mother was not a Christian at the time. But you see, she was answering the why question. Why am I out here in the barn at this time of the night when all my friends are in their bed or watching television? Howdy doody. I guess he didn't come on that early or that late. But she was answering. Now, the question would be, how do you know that, Mom? Well, of course, I was 10 years old, so I never thought about asking that question. But you see, that would be the next question to ask. She is giving the explanation to the why question. And that would supposed to give me the meaning to my question. But then the next question is, but is it true? And of course, as Christians, we're always involved in the truth. I remember one time, I won't give too many particulars, but I remember one time that I was in a post-Soviet state and I was being asked to do an interview on a state television, and I'd gone to the station, and a nice lady came out and she greeted me and she said, we're going to have the interview back in a garden, with a beautiful garden. And she was very articulate with her English, probably better than mine. And as we're walking, I've never met this woman before. The first question out of her mouth was, why do we suffer so much? Now, that's a strange question to ask a complete stranger. And I said, first, why do you think things should be any better than they are? Have you ever seen a perfect environment? She said, no. I said, have you ever seen a thing where there was always justice? And, no. I said, so where did you get that idea from? And she was stunned. She hadn't thought about that. And so I said, is it possible that mankind was not made for trouble, but that it was made for a garden? Because here we are walking out to this beautiful garden. And guess what? There's now a conversation to be had. There's a conversation to be had. Now we're going to work back from meaning to truth. Now, I think we will see this in the Bible. Of course, you know, we can just about find anything in the Bible that we want to support what we want to say. So I searched through the Bible and I found these three. Three examples that appeal to imagination for meaning. Now the first one, and these are ones that I'm quite certain you will know, is in John 4:7, and you remember it's the story of the Samaritan woman who comes to Jesus. She's at the water. She's getting water at Jacob's well. They're in Shechem Valley, and Jesus is resting, and the disciples have gone in to get food. And this Samaritan lady comes, and she's about to bring water up from Jacob's well, which is very deep. And she's got to get water, I guess, for the camels. And Jesus says to her, he begins a conversation with her, but the conversation he begins with is not her need of salvation, but water. Now, why is water important to her? Well, because she's got a pail in her hand, and she's come to fetch water. And so Jesus is going to ask her, he says, give me to drink. That immediately raises a what kind of a question in the Samaritan woman. Do you remember the story? She says, what? Why you, being a Jew, would ask a drink of me? That was important to her, because if you know the history, the Jews and the Samaritans weren't on the best or the friendliest of terms. So she's going to ask, this is the why question. Why are you asking me this? And this is going to set up the framework. We're not real good at doing this as Christians, because we're just so certain that we've got all the answers. And I know we do. We don't have all of them, but maybe you do. I just haven't turned that corner yet. But the fact is, yes, we do believe we have the truth, and that's not being arrogant. But sometimes all we want to do is tell people how much we know. And we don't know if they have any interest in it or not. Now, we think they should, because it's such a great story. But, well, it just may not be that important to them. So he says, give me a drink. She says, she wants to know why. What's the meaning of this? What an interesting thing. What is the meaning of this? You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. And then you see what he does is he engages in that conversation. And as the conversation goes, first she says, I know that you are a Jew. And she gets down to find out, you are the prophet. And he's just worked all as he's been inquiring of her. And then, see, then when he gets down to the point, he's now going to give her the explanation, almost in a backdoor way. He tells her about her past. not to condemn her. He tells her about her past just to let her know that he knows. And that's when she says, remember, she goes into town and she says what? Come and hear this man who has told me all things about herself. And then she says, this is the prophet. Now, here's a way. Now, you haven't done all the work, of course, but you have got to a point where you can now have a serious conversation. Of course, we know how the story goes on. But this is how, in one case, we see the why question comes up. And you know, it finally comes down to where Jesus says, okay, I'll give you living water. And she doesn't really understand even at that point. So there's more information that has to come. But now you see, we're working back to the truth of the claim, not just answering the why question. In Acts 17, we have a different situation. And if you remember, this is where Paul is on Mars Hill, and he's been walking about Mars Hill, and he notices that there is a tomb to the unknown god. And eventually they get into conversation, and he says, oh, you know, I've been walking around here, and I see that you're a very religious people. He didn't condemn them for their idolatry. He just said, I see you're very religious people. And he says, I've noticed that you have I don't know why. I want to call it the tomb of the unknown soldier. I don't know why that is sticking with me. I guess I've been watching too much history. He says, I've noticed that you have an altar to the unknown god. And now he is going to tell them. They don't ask the why question. He just knows there is a why question. That is, they don't have all the answers. So in order just to make up, I mean to fill out, to make sure they've covered all their bases, they have a god you just don't know. So Paul knows this is important to them. That's their affections. That's their sentiments. They're very concerned about what lies ahead. And he said, I'm going to give you some information. I will proclaim to you the unknown god. And people, what do they say? Oh, they don't say, get out of here. What are you talking about? Because he knew from looking at the altar, this was important to them. Because it's important to them, he can now go from meaning and work back to the truth. So he says, he answers the question, because that's what their gods are all about. They're trying to ask, they're trying to find answers to the why question. And one of the why questions they have is, why is the world the way it is? Why is the world the way it is? What is the meaning of all of this? And Paul was saying, in essence, well, I am going to give you information. And so he starts with their concern, that is, of things that are important to them. Now, when you look at an unbeliever, have you ever thought, not in a judgmental way, but have you ever thought to yourself, I wonder what's important to this person? Well, that would be very interesting to figure out what's important to this person. Because remember, we only want to reason about things that have effectively moved us. What's the meaning of all of this? They listen because it's important to them. The meaning is associated with what people think is important. So he's going to give them meaning. And so we know the story, how he tells the story about the god, this god that he's going to talk about. This god doesn't need gifts. This is the god who created the whole world. So he's painting them a framework. Suppose, in a sense, I'm not saying that Paul said, suppose this is true. But I was trying to point out how you do this. And he's thinking, suppose this is the answer. Suppose this is the answer to the question that's inscribed on the altar of the unknown God. So I'm going to give it to you. And then as he moves his way through, he finally gets to what? He gets to the resurrection. And you know, I think it's interesting to point out, do you realize that he had Epicureans and Stoics in front of him, they're philosophers. If he would have said that this God gave immortality, they would have had no problem with that. You know, we're sometimes thinking, oh, I don't want to use words that people might feel a little offended by. No, you've got to tell the truth. And so Paul says, talks about the resurrection. Now, did everybody believe? No. Well, the Bible says what? Some believed?
Dionysius the Areopagite.
So we have some who believe something totally different, and they don't, and they scoff what Paul says, and yet others did what? Others said, maybe we should listen to this man another time. Don't have quite enough information, let's listen to him another time. And then others actually what? They actually believed. So you don't, just because you've gone this route, it doesn't mean that you're going to have the Philippian jailer experience every time. Very few times are people just going to fall on their knees and beg you to tell them, what must I do to be saved? But you don't want to be discouraged by that everybody didn't believe. Of course we'd like to have everybody believe, but be careful about that. So he goes back to the word of truth behind the claim, because the resurrection demonstrates the truth of what he had just said. Now you see, we've moved from meaning, he's given them meaning to their question, now we go to the truth of the meaning, and that's where there's a fallout. We don't want to accept this truth. Another place in 1 Peter 3, and this is somewhat of a different one. If you know, John 1 Peter 3:15, it's the one verse that's on all apologetic literature, yes? Always be ready to give a reason for the hope that lieth within you. But do you know the context? Do you know what the context of that is? You see, there's a why question in here. Peter is answering a why question. What is the why question? What does Peter tell us in that story? What is their question? Their question is, why are you willing to die for your faith? That doesn't make any sense. But is it a good question? Why are you willing to die for your faith? And Peter is going to give an answer. Now, that may alert us to something. I don't know if you very often have unbelievers coming to you and after they've looked at your life and saying, why are you willing to go through this? That's what raised, in this case, it's the lifestyle that raises the question. I'm not sure our lifestyles often raise many questions with the unbeliever. And saying, why are you willing? Because at least in the West, and I don't want to put everybody in that bucket, but the Western world has tried so hard to look like the world so that the world might listen to them. But you see, then that question, the why question, never comes. The question of why are you willing to die? We don't have to worry about the dying aspect. Well, I suppose it may come. So the unbeliever says, why are you living this way? I've often thought that difficulty is the whole issue of evil is really a great way into talking about the gospel, if done properly. But this is a question of people and how they lived. So what is the meaning of this? Why are you living this way? We always talk about truth incarnated. There's not much of it going on today, I'm sorry to say, at least in the evangelical world in the West. They don't see a real difference between the world and ourselves. So they work back from the meaning. Why are you willing? See, it's that they're interested in this. And why are they interested in this? Well, because there's, remember this, the affections, the sentiments. And their sentiments are quite contrary to the sentiments of the Christians. What's important to the Christian is living faithfully to Christ. What's important to the unbeliever is saving your life at all cost. But it's raised the why question. And the why question, it's a meaning question. They just can't figure out, why would you be willing to live this way? I was listening to a young preacher a number of years ago in a post-Soviet state. And it was he was a great preacher. Just a young lad. Of course, anybody under 60 for me is a young lad, if it's a male. And I said to this friend, I said, who is this guy? Oh, he said his dad was a pastor under communism. And I'm thinking, in the West, we would think we need to protect our children. Don't go into the ministry, because you know if you go into the ministry, this might happen to you. And here was a young man who saw his dad not come home nights, Sunday nights after church. And when he did come home, it is evident that he had been beaten. And yet, this young lad, what did he want to do? He wanted to preach. Why? Because it answered the why question. Why is my dad doing this? It's because he teaches this. But why would he be beaten for this? Why would he allow himself to be beaten for this? It's because it's the truth. Because it's the truth. And I thought, oh my goodness, no wonder this young lad stands up with boldness, because he's watched his father live consistent with the truth of the gospel. And he was like the people to whom Peter writes. He was willing to die. Now, he didn't, but he was willing to. So this idea of what's important. So as the world looks at us, do they have any understanding of what is important to us? Can they tell by the way we live what's important to us? Well, if they can't, you see, they're never going to ask the why question of the Christian. So, and it's just one thing. Listen, this is not a how to do things. This is just putting some suggestions out there for you to think about, to say, oh, you know, maybe there's something here. I don't care for a whole lot of methodologies. I'm just thinking here about how do we engage in a natural way with the unbeliever. So I would say that in conclusion, many feel a bit uneasy about this. As we think we should always respond with some of our beliefs, and sometimes that might be the right thing to do at first, but I don't think it's always the right thing to do. Sometimes we search for the why question, and then we try to give an answer from our Christian worldview. As I lectured in universities and still do, secular universities, I never went in and talk about God. If I would have, I'd only been invited once. But I did talk about having transcendent values. And when I would stop, then the Q&A time came. And students would raise their hand and say, "Do you believe in God?" I haven't said anything to that point that I was a believer. But they could tell that what things were important to me by how I was answering questions. And I said, "Yeah, I believe in God." And then, because the next question came, "Are you a Christian?" And here I am with faculty sitting down here. And this is only just a few years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And most of them were still living with their old ideology. But I had brought the subject up. They did. They raised the why questions. And then that was the question. Why would you believe in God? I'm sorry, that's a secret. I can't tell you. The why question. And then they would say, "Are you a Christian?" "Yeah, I'm a Christian." And you know what the question was. Why are you a Christian? How much easier it is when we're answering the why questions. Because they saw that as something that would be abnormal. That wasn't what they didn't think that one should be doing this, but they really wanted to understand, why would anybody travel so far? Why would anybody even believe in this God? Why would anybody even be a Christian? So it really opened up great opportunities to speak. And no one could say that I came in and I had an evangelistic meeting. But in fact, guess what? We did have an evangelistic meeting because I was just answering questions. What kind of questions was I answering? Why questions? However, often that does not work well, especially in the world where Christianity is considered implausible, which is much of our world today. But nonetheless, I think that there are still people who may ask us, but then we take the initiative and ask them questions so we find out about the things that are important to them, things that they have settled their affections on. And then we work from their affections back to explaining and then coming to the truth. Once the meaning question comes, then the apologist moves to explain the meaning, which leads us to talk about what we call the truth of the thing. And that's where we want to go, is it not? We do want to get to the truth of the thing. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father." Beginning an apologetic conversation in a way that appeals to unbelievers' affection, their existential interest, might prompt the hearer to raise the question of meaning. One of the areas, and I don't know how prevalent this is where you live, is the minimalist movement very prevalent where you live? Do you know what the minimalist movement is? There are many people in the West, particularly in the United States, who have become very disenchanted with the busyness of life. Many of them sell everything they have. They keep their job, but then they buy little homes. That's why they're called minimalists. And they think the meaning of life is to be found in not having a lot of material clutter around you. So as you see that, you think, they're trying to answer the why question. Now, do we have come in and we have a better answer to that? That's just one example. There are others who are in this movement who have turned to the Eastern religions. And so they take their entire lunchtime and do yoga or something in order to free up their mind, to release stress, and so to speak. And you see, now I know what? There's something in their life that's important to them. They're willing to do this. Now I come along and ask the question, in a sense. Why is this important to you? Why are you willing to give up your lunchtime to practice yoga? Why are you willing? I mean, these little homes, well, I suspect most of these little homes, we could put at least six of these little homes that people are living in now, in this room. They're about five, some get as high as 800 square feet, so I don't know what that is in meter, but they're really tiny. And now there's a whole industry that's grown up around making little appliances to fit in these little houses. I don't know. But you see, it'll only be a fad. I mean, you understand there's something really underneath, right, that has causing them to do this. But will it satisfy? No. Is it an attempt to bring order to their lives? Yes. They want order in their lives, and they feel their world is very disordered to them. So there we have it. Order is important to them. And so this raises the why question. Why do you want order in your life? Why not just live with the disorder that everybody else is living? And of course the answer is, it's not very satisfying. And then the next question is, well, why isn't it satisfying? And asking these kind of questions. Well, I don't know how helpful all of that is, but, and again, I'm not suggesting that this is the one way you do with everybody. I'm only saying, I'm putting out thoughts there for you to think about. When you engage an unbeliever the next time, how might you go about it in asking the why questions, to find out what's important to them? And by the way, don't assume that you know what they think is important to them. You need to really ask questions to find out.